Okay, good morning. So I wrote there a recap of what we did last time. I will just go through it briefly in a second. Let me first write a nice reference for the lecture of today. It's a short summary and full of references, so it makes more precise statement than what I would make today, because of otherwise it would take a long time to provide all the technical definitions. But it's very concise, and yeah, it's full of references with all the original works referred to. So you can, I think it's a nice resource. Okay. So, last time, we investigated the consequences of general covariance. And so, we define general covariance, the general covariance of a local form alpha over spacetime and field space, as the following property. If we have a diffeomorphism xi, which is a vector field on our manifold, we say that if its field space variation along the action of this diffeomorphism is equal to the lead derivative as a spacetime form, then we call alpha general covariant. So, or background independent is the other word that is often used. So, as you see, this intertwines the action of diffeos on F and M. So, it's quite something quite special about diffeomorphism theory. This wouldn't make sense for other types of symmetries. Now, in a general covariant theory, for which the Lagrangian is general covariant, and here one needs to be very creative about fonts, because there are lots of L's, automatically, without in fact using any property, any of the specific properties of L, we can find such a formula for the would-be Hamiltonian flow equation of the diffeomorphisms. So here I haven't used any specificity of GR. Of course, for GR, we would have that omega as a, and theta have a specific forms, and so does Q. But in general, this is, and we gave these formulas, but this holds, this just follows from general covariance. Because if you remember, here we had the obstruction is the field space lead derivative of theta minus the boundary term, like the residual term here for L, that what remains. And since they are action of diffeomorphisms, we can rewrite them, repackage them using our formulas in terms of spacetime lead derivatives, which can be rearranged to give these types of formulas. So we see therefore that in general for diffeomorphisms, we do not expect an off-shell Hamiltonian flow equation for the symmetries in the covariant in this covariant formalism. And there are two types of obstruction. One is mild, so to say, and one is harsher. So the mild one is obstruction number one, which is a bulk obstruction, so to say, is on sigma. And it's there every time we look at diffeomorphisms which are transverse to our hypersurface. This obstruction goes away when we go on shell. And the intuition is that these transverse differences are about time evolution, so we need the equation of motion to relate what is happening at two different instances of the surface. And something like this we have also seen for global symmetries in a scalar theory. So it's not too surprising, but it has important consequences for the off-shell analysis of general relativity, especially in the canonical formulas. Whereas the second obstruction is more severe, but is there only when we're looking at manifolds, surfaces with boundaries. So in general, if you have a closed universe and sigma is a Cauchy surface, then these terms do not appear. And again, they're there only when xi is transverse to the corner, to the boundary of sigma. And they do not vanish on shell a priori, but they're zero, if there is no boundary of sigma. And we saw that the intuition is that they're there because they actually change, in a sense, they change the subsystems we're looking at. So they capture the fact that you're changing the region to, like, at least pictorially. Okay, so today we want to move towards, well, there are, yes, Chris.
So I think I'm a bit confused about this general covariance condition, because to me, naively, it seems like if K and L, like the degrees of alpha, were not equal to each other, then alpha wouldn't be generally covariant. But that seems wrong.
K and L.
K wasn't equal to L.
No, the point is that the lead derivatives do not change the degree of the form.
Yeah.
So the degree of this form is the same as the degree of that one.
But I guess as a tensor in field space of degree K, alpha should transform as a lead derivative as that time degree tensor, and then the lead derivative in space time will transform as a tensor of degree L. And those transformations will be different if K and L are equal, aren't they?
Again, the degrees you're referring to are these K and L. And the lead derivative does not change that degree. So this is the only thing that's... I understand your worry, but is not... It's taken care of, in a sense, by... Okay. It's... in fact, the fact that you can make... It's a non-trivial statement that this does work. But in fact... So this statement looks trivial if all your fields. So if alpha does not have any background structure, which means there is no any quantity entering it is part of your field space. Like in GR, you have that theta, for example, is some covariant derivatives, which are functions of g mu nu, and you have some delta g mu nu. So everything is a function of g mu nu. All the quantities that appear and build your tensors, then it's kind of trivial, because if you modify your metric everywhere it appears by a diffeomorphism, it's obvious that you would get this, because that theta is written in a tensorial form. So in that case, it's trivial. So what this is saying is that first of all, that the metric of your spacetime, if it's necessary to write alpha, sometimes it's not, like in a topological field theory, but in general physical theories, like scalar field theory, Young-Mills, and so on, you need the metric. And if that metric is not part of your field space, then when you look at the left-hand side, you're not varying it, but you're just varying your dynamical fields. So you're not changing all the tensors appearing in your formulas, and so these would not hold. But if the metric is part of your field space together with any other object entering alpha, then this looks a bit trivial in a sense. Yes.
Does the background independence of the Lagrangian imply that potential is also background independent?
I would say so. If you want to add conditions for safety, if you want to be sure, I don't see how it means that your teeth. So you what you could do is to say, oh, this is the naive theta, but I can always add some total derivative to it or something like that. And now this total derivative, you make it depend on some external vector field that you choose, which you don't.
Do I need to introduce that?
No, you don't. That's what I'm saying. So it's not guaranteed because there are ambiguities, and the way you fix them might introduce some problems. But a priori, you will find expressions when you do the computation for this theta, which is a function of the fields entering the Lagrangian. You're just taking variations of the Lagrangian, so it will be it kind of, I would say, it must work. I don't see how it could go wrong. I wouldn't say it's a theorem because I don't see what could go wrong.
But it's because of the ambiguity of theta that we have.
But yeah, you could say, I don't know, that theta is equal to the naive theta plus d of something. And if this d of something, I don't know, let's say, so this is in GR could be the one I wrote the other day. So here you would have to add something that is the pure divergence, of, I don't know how to call it, let's call it beta AB. So some with these antisymmetric, so that is divergence is automatically zero. It's like adding an exact form. And if this beta happens to be, I don't know, a background structure, for example, some vector field that is not part of my original field space, I could do that, but it's kind of silly to do it unless there are very good reasons, and it would indeed mess up your what follows. But this will only be a function of GAB. If you introduce your extra stuff that is not a...
Then, for example, so if I want to think of the field space derivative minus space time derivative as like a measure of background, it sounds a bit weird that you have to introduce a background field so that theta is background independent.
No, but the point is that it will not be on its own background dependent. Well, we wrote a theta which is not background independent, and it's compatible with the Lagrangian. So we can be happy with that choice. I don't know which scenarios you have in mind. If you have some specific idea, we can discuss it later. But at this level, it seems to me artificial to introduce issues. Maybe there are good reasons. So for example, we will see later that when we study asymptotic infinity, since it's a way to impose boundary conditions on your equations, boundary conditions are background structures because you are asking your field to do something, and usually you say, oh, they should be asymptotically Minkowski or something like that. And therefore, you're telling your fields what they have to become. And this thing cannot be dynamical because otherwise it wouldn't work. And so, okay, if you're imposing specific boundary conditions, you might be introducing structures. And in fact, I also mentioned last time that in this case, we will see later how it works in a specific case, but you are introducing some background structure and restricting to the sum of field space which satisfies certain conditions. And when you pull back this expression to that part of field space, so you restrict to all the metrics that have a certain fixed property, then it could be that this term that is evaluated, strictly speaking, at the boundary has some extra properties that depend on that background structure. But at this level, how I wrote it, I haven't done that, is on F, where I'm not fixing anything. Everything is free to vary as much as it likes. So I don't see how in this formula that can happen. So in the case we will look at, there will be some boundary background structure, which are boundary conditions. And thanks to those, this there will be delta exact, and we will be able to reabsorb it. So it will actually be useful for something, but you're doing something more. it's not pertinent to the formula as I wrote it so far. Okay. Now we want to move towards applying this formula to black hole spacetime. So I need to take a detour to tell you a bit more what black holes are and so on. So I hope we can come back from this detour and not get stuck inside the horizon to conclude the argument. So before talking about black holes as such, I need to introduce Killing horizons. So this is a geometric, these are geometric objects that have nothing to do a priori with Einstein's equations and so on. They're just proper, just possible type of surfaces that can appear in Lorentzian manifolds. So let's say M is a MGAB is a Lorentzian manifold. So we define K. Well, definition of what? Of Killing horizon. So, okay, and we call it K. So what is K? K is a null surface such that its null generator LA coincide with with the restriction to sigma, 2k, sorry. Of a Killing vector field, chi a on M. Well, I should say on Mg. So what is the picture for this situation? I will draw two. So we have some null hypersurface, and we have, and these are its null generators, if that makes sense. Is it clear how to read this picture?
Mean generators like in a distributional kind of sense, like as far as forming surfaces.
So they are
it's like the Killing vector field.
So a null surface of this type will be so L is tangent to what this means is that L is tangent to K and is null essentially.
Yeah.
And so this K will be some surface C times the flows of this vector. So here I've just drawn what L is with respect to K inside my spacetime M. And here I want to draw how this relates to the killing. So my L's are these. So this is LA. And how does it relate to chi? What is the picture one should have in mind? Well, chi will be some killing vector fields whose flow look probably like this. And it becomes null only at k. It doesn't need to be a null. It doesn't need to be a null killing vector field. It can be something that is time-like, then becomes null, and then it changes to space-like again. So you can, from the way I drew it, you can see that a nice example of this is the Rindler horizon. Right? So example. Horizon in Minkowski. So this is, let's say, z equal t. Well, I want it to be, well, in fact, let's, or portion of this Rindler horizon. We will be more specific in a moment. Now, a remark, an important remark, which will cause a lot of confusions if you start playing around with this type of geometries, is that null vectors are weird. So LA, this LA as a vector, is indeed tangent to K, but it is also normal to K. It's not, so the opposite of being tangent is being transverse, at least as I use the word. It means that it has components in the transverse direction. So, well, it just means that it's not tangent. So that's what I mean by transverse. Whereas normal, it means that it's dot product with any tangent vector is zero. LA VA equals zero for all V tangent to K. And so for those in these directions, in the, let's say, the direction along C is clear, I'm just choosing a basis that is orthogonal. But L, since L is normal to itself, that's why it can be tangent and normal at the same time to the surface. So because LA is parallel and normal to itself. OK, so this is, so when you speak, or I speak, I need to be careful about this kind of language. And it can be confusing because we're so much wired to think about normal as meaning transverse that it's very confusing.
What is a vector tangent to K?
Well, the tangent space is defined in the usual way. That you don't even need a metric to define tangent t.
No, I want to specify k by scalar function such that the surface is when this function is constant.
Yeah.
The normal.
If it's a level set of something, it means if you have if sigma is the level set of some function, then V is tangent to sigma if and only if IV df is equal to 0. But you don't even need this. You can define tangency to submanifolds abstractly, like you don't. But yeah, this is a possible way. Locally in coordinates, this is always what happens. Okay, so the consequence of this remark. Oh, let me write it over here. The consequence of this remark is that we have chi A is killing and chi A at my killing horizon is 0. It implies that dA of, let me write it with the index low, chi b is equal, it must be proportional, and here again there are lots of k's, so I'll be careful to write them slightly differently. So it must be proportional to chi a, and I call the proportionality constant minus 2k. We will see what that is in a second. But what follows from these properties is the fact that this is proportional to chi A. This is what this statement is about, not so much about the number in front.
At the horizon or everywhere?
At the horizon. Well, no, at the horizon. Or at. Let me write it like this, so both sides are evaluated at k. Okay? So, yeah?
What if chi A itself vanishes at the horizon?
It cannot vanish everywhere on the horizon, because otherwise it wouldn't be a generator. So it might vanish in certain spots of the horizon, as we will see, but it cannot vanish on open sets. Otherwise, it would not fit into that definition. So why this is the case? So we see that if something is not, let's try to think as usual, let's say. So chi is constant on the surface, so it means that its gradient must point away from the surface, right? So it will be proportional to the normal, but the normal here is chi for the reason we talked about before. So in particular, this means that since chi is constant on the surface, if I contract it with the tangent vector to the surface, I will find 0. So this is, and to find 0, even when I contract with chi, I need to plug in chi itself. So that's what is slightly weird, and it follows from those observations. Okay, so this allows us to define the proportionality constant. Let's say, this is definition. Kappa, so defined, is called the surface gravity of K. An observation another way of writing this equation. It's just a one-line computation using the fact that we have a Killing vector. Okay, so how does it work? You just distribute this, use the Killing property to switch the indices, and you find that. Super easy. So we see that kappa is, this kappa is essentially the acceleration of chi at the horizon, normalized in a certain way. So this is not really a four velocity, because the four velocity is always normalized. This is not normalized, so it cannot really be thought as an acceleration full stop. But morally speaking, it is the acceleration of chi. And the reason why it's called the surface gravity is precisely it follows from this formula. So if you define a four velocity, which at every point is tangent to k, is proportional to k, it means that you have to renormalize this object. Then you find that its acceleration will be proportional to k up to a redshift factor, which is the norm of chi, essentially. And as we will see, the norm of chi will go to 1 at infinity if everything is well. So in the nice cases, this will be the acceleration of the observer, which must be infinite because it's trying to pull away from a null surface, which is infinitely accelerated, of course, but up to a redshift factor, which is sort of trivial. I can pull out a finite number. So it is sometimes said, oh, the acceleration is seen from infinity or something like that. But morally speaking, you can think of this as a renormalized acceleration of the horizon. That's why it's called the surface gravity. Creation of an observer along chi. Let's say very close. So if it wants to be on k on a null surface, it must be infinitely fast. So it must keep accelerating infinitely. But these are like locally they look a lot like Rindler observers, right? They're infinitely accelerated when you want to push them to the horizon, but if you renormalize if you normalize them by the norm of chi, what is left over is precisely this this kappa. Okay, so next we start understanding a little bit what this horizon looks like, which properties they have, and now there is a special case of particular interest, which is a bifurcate Killing horizon. So what is this situation? Well, this situation is the following. We have two Killing horizons. For the same vector field, Killing vector field. And these two surfaces intersect at intersect at C, which is a codimension 2 surface called the bifurcation surface. So this is the definition of what a bifurcated horizon is. The drawing is something like this. K1 and K2, and this is my C. So Rindler is precisely such a case. So we have Z, we have T, we have K1, we have K2, and this surface is Z, and of course my killing is the boost. So if you look at the boost generator, you will notice that it will be something like T dz minus z dt. I hope I'm getting the signs right. Maybe plus. And so what happens at this, at the point of intersection, it vanishes at C. So this is a general fact. Proposition CA at C must vanish. In fact, there is also a converse to this proposition. If there exists a C of codimension 2 such that chi at C vanishes, then chi is a bifurcation. So I always denote chi killing vectors, and so that should be what I mean there. Okay, so.
So if I can find killing vector that vanishes at some codimension.
Yeah, then you have a bifurcated killing horizon somewhere. Well, not somewhere that hinges on that surface. We will later assume that this C is actually a two-sphere. Just we don't want crazy topologies. We will just take simple cases. Okay, so why do we care about killing horizons? We care about killing horizons because, as by the theorem I will now tell you about, they are intimately related to black hole spacetimes. So a stationary black hole spacetime, once you maximally extend it, and I will explain what that means, it will be a spacetime containing killing horizons. So we can use their very peculiar properties and nice properties to study stationary black holes. That's the idea. Are relevant when studying stationary. And stationary could just mean late times, right? Black hole solutions. So if we wait long enough, we will have a stationary black hole. So we can just think of the late time black hole as its own object, geometric object, and we can start from there. But I'm rushing ahead of myself, so let's start from the beginning. So I cannot give a full course on black holes, of course, and asymptotically flat spacetimes, but I hope you at least have heard about some of these terms. Otherwise, please, you can ask questions, but I will try to dodge them as much as I can. and give you as minimal as an answer as possible to keep things self-contained. So in an asymptotically flat spacetime, a black hole B spacetime M. The black hole region is defined as M minus, so the part of M that does not sit in the past of asymptotic infinity, asymptotic null infinity. So region that does not sit in the past of asymptotic null infinity. So this is what it means, and the drawing is the following. We don't know what happens here, we don't care, but we have, this is my scribe plus in the Penrose diagram, this. So when I look at the past, I'm looking at this. So this is my I minus of scribe plus. And so the black hole region is in fact the complement. So this is, this is B. So it's, you define it as whatever region is causally causally disconnected from asymptotic infinity. So you are defining it precisely as that region from which things cannot escape. So that's what definition is. Is quite, so the popular science definition of a black hole is in fact quite precise. It's exactly how you define it mathematically, which doesn't happen very often. So it's a nice feature. Now, what is the horizon? The horizon H is the boundary of B. So I'm lacking nice colors, but this is the boundary of B. Okay, so now we can mention these there are some rigidity theorems that says, while you are in this situation, you have assumed that you have an asymptotically flat spacetime, so we are already putting some strong restrictions to the type of solution we are looking at. And second, we are assuming that there is an horizon, a black hole horizon somewhere. So even more restrictions. The second is not such a strong restriction, in fact. But and now we want to say something about what kind of shape this horizon can be. So theorem one, it's by Carter and Hawking. Again, for references, please check the Wald paper. It says that the event horizon H of a stationary black hole is stationary implies H is a Killing horizon, And in nice cases, so there is a technical hypothesis, the relevant Killing vector field takes the following form. So where TA is a Killing vector field itself. So is a time-like Killing vector field. Well, I shouldn't say it's a time-like Killing vector field, sorry. It's a Killing vector field that close to infinity at scry plus coincides with Minkowski's DT. Does this statement make sense? So it approaches at infinity time translation symmetry. So close to infinity, outside here will be time-like. It can change signature, but to change signature, it has to go across the surface where it becomes null. And that's the horizon, right? So inside is precisely that picture that I drew there. Phi, on the other hand, so stationary essentially means that such a Killing vector field exists. So this is the definition of stationarity. It tells me that M contains such an object. That's how stationarity is defined. I think that's correct. Is that correct? I should be careful though. I don't know. That's definitely confusing stationarity with staticity. I'm sorry. I'm blanking right now, but. So, yeah, one has to be a bit careful there. So I will fix this. Tell you the answer next time. So phi A is a similar object that at infinity is rotation. It is a Killing vector field that goes to rotations at infinity. Instead of time translations, it gives d phi at infinity. So this extra object.
Aldo, static is for time independent and irrotational. And stationary is just time independent.
Yeah, but I wanted the definition in terms of vector fields, of Killing. So this last omega, the existence of certain Killing with certain properties.
Yeah, but I think irrotational means that precisely there is the
So this omega is called the if you look at that paper, it says exactly what it is. It's called the angular velocity of the horizon. So as you see, here we have the way, so I want to make an observation. You may think, oh, but chi is defined up to rescalings. They must be global rescaling. They cannot be local rescalings. But how am I fixing this ambiguity? Well, I'm fixing this ambiguity because I want this to be dt at infinity, so norm 1. So I'm fixing the coefficient in front of this guy. And so this is essentially the ratio between the other two pieces. So this is a geometrically defined object. It does not depend on the normalization, and I'm choosing the normalization of chi to be the one that has t as the time translations at infinity. So this is a time-like killing, this is a space-like killing, so I can distinguish them. This is the only time-like killing
The angular velocity is a globally defined quantity.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yes, it's a number. Yes. So it's part of the theorem. So that's why they're rigid. These objects are very rigid in the sense that they have some very. So this is just a number. So in curve would be. The angular velocity of Kerr.
It's not the generator of the killing horizon, right?
Chi is the generator of the killing horizon. That's how I'm using.
Well, that was L.
Well, at L coincides with chi. Chi is defined everywhere on the manifold.
Yes.
At the horizon, L must coincide with the restriction of some chi, and this is the chi. Next, I'm losing a page. Oops, okay. Okay, so I want to give another two results. One is the zeroth law. Oh, by the way, these are two separate theorems. I should say Carter, Hawking, not Carter and Hawking. And they have slightly different technical hypotheses, but they give similar results, so I'm kind of merging them in one rough statement. So the zero law tells, which is due to Carter and Bardeen, tells that k, kappa is constant on h, and this is a kinematical statement, or, again, probably it's Carter, Bardeen more than N Bardeen, but is constant on kappa on shell of Einstein's equation. So what does this mean? It means that if you have a black hole horizon, then it has constant surface gravity, and it follows from the fact that I'm assuming that I have an asymptotically flat space-time, and so it is a particular definition of H. Whereas if I take a generic killing horizon, then I need some extra inputs to find this result. And so I assume the Einstein's equation and some, I think, energy condition. I don't remember which one. But there are some extra hypotheses. But what we're interested in is the case when H is a killing horizon itself and we are on shell, so we can use this result. So this constancy, we already see that kappa is thermalized on K, and so already the word they used, we as you know, there are analogies between kappa and temperature. So a system at equilibrium has constant temperature, and here kappa has a similar property. So we can ask what happens. So if this analogy makes sense, it makes sense also to ask what happens when So these are degenerate solutions. So K equals zero, well, definition, an extremal black hole. Extremal if its surface gravity vanishes, and there are theorems that say that extremal black holes are unstable. So we consider it as not being physically relevant. And if you want to look up a name to check out these theorems, there's also a web page with some summaries of the results. Duffermos, he's a mathematical physicist, so his papers are extremely technical, but there are some summaries of them which are quite readable. So the last theorem I want to conclude with so essentially we will not consider them. Not physical. Like we take them as not physical. So if we have a non-extremal black hole, let's say I have H with kappa equals zero, so we have a black hole which is non-extremal. What happens? In this case, the maximal extended, which I'm not going to define, spacetime representing a stationary black hole solution is such that H is a killing horizon, which we knew, that bifurcates. So what is the picture? The picture is the following. We can think of a situation where we have we have some matter collapsing into our black hole. So we have the black hole region, we have our horizon. So this is a collapse. So it's a physical situation, but at late times, what happens is that this black hole will settle down. And after it settles down, it's stationary. And therefore, we can think of it as coming as a piece of a maximally extended black hole, So we don't need to say what happens in the far past. So I leave these open over there. And so this region is the same as the other one. And this is our maximal extension. And we have the black hole region over here. We have our horizon over there. And killing vector fields, which did not exist in the left picture, but they exist in the maximally extended case, which are given by these So this is chi, and so we have a black hole region, and here there is, on the other side of the bifurcation surface, we have the white hole region. Which can be defined abstractly as by replacing square minus with square plus and the past with the future. So this is the picture, and this we see where our bifurcation surface comes in. And to conclude, the last statement is that chi A at C, of course, vanishes. And there we have this nice formula. Which will be extremely useful in the next lecture.
What do you mean by maximally extending this black hole space-time?
So you have some. You can imagine at late time is stationary, and I look at so maximal extension is essentially you take a portion of your space, is like what we did with Kruskal when we built Kruskal. So we made sure that all possible curves were, all geodesics were complete, so they would not end somewhere in nowhere for no good reason. So you try to find the largest possible spacetime that satisfies your symmetries, of which what you have is a portion, essentially. So you know that at late time you're stationary, so you evolve it backwards just using the staticity property. So you look for the largest possible spacetime, which coincides with that and is static in the same way. So you know that asymptotically you have some killing vectors because you know it's static, and you just build it backwards. And so in doing that, you find this bigger space. But it's completely determined by this region. Because, you know, the staticity means things do not evolve anymore. So I can evolve them backwards, except that it's non-trivial because the geometry is complex. Well, it's complicated. And so at some point you will find that things, in a sense, do look different because there is a necessarily one bifurcation surface appearing. So staticity here is a subtle concept, but you can think of this surface as being a property of the late-time black hole, in a sense. It's uniquely associated to whatever you can find up here. So it's a... We will study this spacetime, but not because we think it's physical, because we think of it as representing the late time, a late time black hole. Like it encodes the properties of the late time properties of a black hole spacetime. So that's why these surfaces, which might be weird, they do not exist in collapses, are still relevant to study physical situations.
So basically, we are trying to change our coordinates so that we don't have a singularity anymore at the horizon and Driscoll coordinates, and that's how we end up with a black.
Oh, here there is no singularity either.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just, so there are, so here you know that at late time you have a Schwarzschild solution, for example, but the Schwarzschild solution with a, or Kerr, or something else if you have lots of matter fields around, et cetera, et cetera. So this is quite agnostic about the type of matter fields you have as long as they satisfy certain energy conditions. So it's a super general theorem. But let's say for simplicity, I know that I end up with something that looks like a Schwarzschild at late time. But this is just a late time picture. So you know it only in this region. Here could be a total mess, right? But since you know that it will approach Schwarzschild, you know that the maximally extended version of the Schwarzschild spacetime is Kruskal. And we actually built it during the tutorial of the relativity course. And Kruskal looks like this. It's two copies of the same. So essentially, these theorems are telling you that this picture of late-time Schwarzschild that can be completed to Kruskal is fully general. Of course, this will not be Kruskal in general because that will not be Schwarzschild. But the fact that there is a maximally extended spacetime with the bifurcation surface and so on associated to it is general.
And also, why did you
put out? Oh, it's just that here I just mean, oh, I have some matter fields
and
that.
Goes into the black.
Hmm?
An observer goes
into. No, there is no. What?
A time like trajectory.
No, you can think of these as some mass. So these pictures are all squashed and stretched in weird ways. So you shouldn't think that this is larger than that. When things approach this deep, here you are compressing the entire Cauchy slice, the space-like Cauchy slice, to something very small. So you shouldn't take scales seriously in these pictures. The only thing that you can take seriously is null directions. So the null directions on these diagrams are the same as null directions in true spacetime, but distances are completely all over the place. So here you can imagine a bunch of massive particles coming together, getting closer and closer, although it doesn't look like it. They get closer and closer until they are so dense that they form a black hole. At some point, they enter the horizon, which is defined teleologically, but you know the final state of your evolution. And this is what I mean by a collapse. This is a bunch of matter that gets closer and closer, denser and denser, forms a black hole. The black hole rings and then settles down. And then late time, you get Kerr. Let's see. So this is what I mean by this picture.
I'm slightly confused because I think David had a different picture for collapse.
It had evaporation also.
It? What did you say? I didn't.
In David's class, he drew a Penrose diagram that was supposed to model evaporation.
Oh, with weirder stuff up here. Yeah, no, so this is a fully classical picture of, yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you wanted to make it like semi-quantum, like in order to have Hawking radiation, the radiation would travel along the null direction along the horizon?
Yeah, you cannot have a... So I've witnessed authoritative general relativists fighting about the shape of a Penrose diagrams with collapse. So I will not try to answer this question on record. No, what I mean is a very subtle question that I don't think it's a subtle idea. Some people draw it like, oh, you have something like this. Some people will say, no, this is absolute nonsense. There is just some quantum region down here, and things can go through and come out of it. So, and maybe even other things in between that I don't even remember. Okay, so see you on Monday.